In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
True crime, journalism, and a look at what really goes on behind bars. From SDPB, today is Monday, August 25th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a conversation with Jim Reese. He's the author of a forthcoming book, Coming to a Neighborhood Near You. Reese was shaken as a young boy by the news of a serial killer in his neighborhood. As a high school student, he was shaken again when a classmate fell victim to violent crime. As Reese went on to college and to life as a poet and college professor, those early exposures clung to him. They began to further erode his sense of security. Jim Reese's latest book looks at our relationship to crime and punishment, what it means to live life on the edge of safety and sobriety. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to spend this hour with author Jim Reese. His book, Coming to a Neighborhood Near You, The Repercussions of Crime and Punishment, comes out next month. Now, this is going to be an intense hour. We'll explore some of the worst things a human being can do to another and how society responds to those cases. If you have younger listeners with you now, this is not the show for them. Jim Reese joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Let's open up his book on the ways the criminal justice system often fails victims, secondary victims, and perpetrators. We begin with a reading from Jim Reese.
I never thought I had the authority to write about my friend Christina's rape and murder. But when I first mentioned her murder and how it affected my classmates and me in my book Bone Chalk, readers wanted to learn more. Fans and journalists also talked about serial killer John Jubert, who had abducted kids and then murdered them for no apparent reason. I felt we needed to try to understand more, but I never thought this would result in a book. I didn't think I would search for years learning about and understanding trauma and what crime does to families, communities, and secondary victims. And so the book started as, you know, this, I thought, a chronological collection of anecdotes and lessons from working in prisons for 14 years, these brief snapshots that I had and poems I was writing, and it ended up turning into something I would have never imagined. Writing it has allowed me to explore something much larger than myself, something spiritual, an investigation and interrogation of my beliefs and ideas. During this journey, I uncovered so much more, and it helped me process the fear serial killer John Jubert cast across our city when I was 11, when he abducted kids and murdered them, dumping their mutilated bodies on Giles Road, which was a brown gravel ribbon that I could see from my back porch. More importantly, during my investigation, it has helped me process the grief I have over the rape and murder of my teenage friend by a classmate that used to help me with my homework. I was inspired to write this book to give voice for victims who had theirs taken away forever. It's a book about fear, discovery, rehabilitation, and redemption, about the repercussions of crime and punishment. I'm excited that readers and listeners will learn how I sought to understand addiction, trauma, and what crime does to families, communities, secondary victims, and what mercy and rehabilitation could mean in the work of moving forward.
Jim Reese, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Lori. This is my first interview for this book, and I'm so glad it's with you.
You thought you were writing one thing, as you just told us there, and it ended up being something much, much different. Was there a moment as a writer where you were able to just let go into that?
Yeah, you know, it was hard because I was writing this a lot at night. I would carry it around with me for years. And I had all those brief snapshots, these poems I was writing, but I knew they needed to be, there was such a bigger story to tell. But the whole criminal justice, our punishment system, addiction, that just seemed to be too big of a monster for me to put into one book. So I ended up buying it like a 6x6 piece of tin from a barn, and I bought all these little magnets from Amazon, and mm-hmm. I just started putting all those poems in threads together, and I'd be moving them around, and the gonzo journalism thread went throughout. The thread of my friend's murder and trying to understand that thread was there. So a thread about addiction and evil, the case and the retrial of the guy that murdered my friend, because he was a minor when he did it. Mm-hmm. So all these things came back up, and they were always brewing there too. And I suppose, you know, when you're working in various prisons, you know, I was working in the top 10 cushiest federal prison camp in the nation. Then I went to work with the men's and women's state prisons here in South Dakota. We were training in San Quentin, trying to get into some other prisons like New Folsom to see their arts programs and come back and apply them here. So there's this educational component and rehabilitation component and all these voices that are just spread all over. Yeah, I think once I started seeing all those magnets on the tin, then I could visualize it.
This is a book.
Yeah. This can happen. And I have the great fortune to work with award-winning writer Kent Meyer. Kent Meyer's here in South Dakota, and he's an extraordinary content editor. Mm.
The Work of Wolves and many other books, yeah.
Yeah. Twisted Tree and
Black Hill State University. Yep. Hi, Kent.
Yeah. And,
yeah.
No, but he, after he was giving me suggestions and helping me develop, you know, he would say, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? After a year of that, I thought, okay, I got it ready. I'm going to show it to Kent, and I think I'm ready to go. And I remember driving to Sioux Falls, and he goes, Jim, this is a good first draft.
Yeah.
And now what I think you need to do is go put these into pillars instead of the threads going in and out and in and out. So then I organized the book into the first section, which is the shadows we carry.
Yeah.
And then the second section, I'm talking about gonzo journalism and redefining gonzo. And I wanted to talk about that too, because I learned so much about what Charles Bowden was doing on the border with the war and on drugs.
We're gonna get to some of this before we move into some of the middle part of the book. I want to start at the beginning,
okay?
Because you do have this early experience of trauma in your life, but it's not a crime that happened to you. It's the death of your friend by someone that you knew. And it takes you a long time to come to the realization and the acceptance that this did affect you. You want to outrun it.
Yeah, I did.
There's something about growing up at this time in our American culture, in South Dakota, it's probably the same in other places too, but this is where this is Nebraska, but in the Midwest, where we're from, there was a sense that you shouldn't feel the things that you felt. A really interesting part where you talk about wondering if you could have done something to prevent it. Tell me about that.
I think one of the things when I started really digging as deep as I could, of course that feeling came up. Could we have stopped it, right?
Yeah.
She was babysitting overnight, a little girl, and the mom would go to nursing school and then go to work at night so she could complete her degree. And the two perpetrators showed up at the house, I think the night before, from what I remember, the facts of the case, you know, so there was some warning signs there. She wasn't dating him anymore.
You know you couldn't have stopped it.
Yeah, I know.
That's what I'm asking you.
No, yeah. There's nothing I could have done.
You struggle in the book with that. You struggle with this idea that is there something you could have done, but yet the fact that nobody did anything means everybody kind of failed. So there's a guilt. There's a secondary trauma. There's just a lot happening that you have to wrestle with. That's fair to say, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing I could have done. And even the last time I remember the last time we were together very vividly going to a dance club that we always like to go to. Mm-hmm. And we weren't talking about her ex-boyfriend. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was a brief relationship. So mm-hmm. I would think that if she was concerned about him, she would have brought it up, you know? And it's just that idea that it was always there and we didn't know what to do with it. And then you think, yeah, maybe I could have done this or maybe I could have done that. But, you know, I wasn't best friends with Christina. I didn't know her family or her siblings, not that I can remember. I mean, we picked each other up from our houses and then we'd go to the Swing, which was a cool dance club in the middle of Omaha. And she was a year older than me, too. And, and you know, she just made me feel special, you know, like we were just friends. But it was one of those moments, too, where I think as a young male teenager, for me anyway, I realized, hey, I can be just friends with her. I'm not interested in dating her. She's not interested in dating me. We're just friends. And at that age, you know, that just doesn't happen a lot. You know, the guys were hanging out with guys, girls are hanging out with girls. But we like to just escape the cliques and all the things in our school and go and dance.
Yeah. Were you able to mourn her? This book is part of that process for you.
Yeah, I think in the last 5 years, probably more so than ever. I mean, it was all so strange, you know. There's 700 people at our funeral. The guy that I write about X in the book, he was on the run for over 2 weeks after he was initially questioned by police. And, you know, you're in high school. You don't have Snapchat or Facebook or anything like that at that time. So you just have rumors and stories going everywhere. And then they would flash his picture on the news. And you would see that, but then people in the high school are like, well, we know where he's at. And he was exactly where everybody said he was at. And that's alarming, right?
Yeah.
Her murder tampered down violence momentarily, I think, in the school. But then there is this heightened, I can't even explain it, this fear that everybody had.
Yeah. This could happen here.
I mean, for what? Dating the wrong person?
Right.
And so that was, I mean, what do you do
with
that?
And this changes who you are on a number of levels, because here you are now still writing about it. You go to college, and one of the projects that you want to take on as a young journalist is campus safety.
Yeah.
Because you're studying journalism then, yeah.
Yeah, what happened was we were in the newsroom and it was early, and I remember somebody ran into the newsroom and said, we need you to cover this story immediately. A woman was raped on campus. And they got in through the basement door to the women's dorm room. And you know, in college, besides being a journalist, I was also the college mascot for all the wrong reasons. So I spent a lot of time on campus as a freshman. And what you did know is if you were very bored that you could go down a manhole and go anywhere you wanted on campus. And that just triggered. I thought of that right away. And we talked to our journalism professor and he said, okay. Well, grab a crowbar, go down a manhole, take a camera with you, and see if the doors are open. And And then, you know, right away, well, what if we get caught? He's like, well, if you get caught and get in trouble, I'll bail you out. But we wanted to see if this was...
We wanted to document whether this is a safety concern.
Yeah. We also took a sophomore criminal justice major with us because I was also a pretty outspoken writer and journalist at the time. You know, so we took... So there are three of us. And we did this at 5 o'clock, right in the middle of the campus, right as everybody was going to eat at the GAG. That was our cafeteria. And we pried open the manhole, which isn't like the easiest thing to do, and it's not quiet, right? Mm-hmm. So we're prying this thing open. People are walking by us. Hey, what are you guys doing? We're going to go down in these tunnels. And so we left it open. We went down in the tunnels, and we were able to get right away into the brand new business building that was built on campus, and the doors were open, and I took some pictures of some people's offices. So this must have been like 5:45 by then. And then we came out of there, walked down these, you know, cinder hallways underneath the campus with little lights above us, you know, with the cage around the light bulb. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty lit up. And then we were heading straight to the women's dorm room. And right when we got to that basement door, there was a fence. And then there was a door behind it. The fence was open. The door was open. So we opened them. We took a lot of pictures, had the criminal justice guy stand by it, shut the doors, came back out of the tunnels, and nobody was around. We did have a campus security person driving around. And I said, you know what? We need to get caught doing this. And I said, let's do it again. So we went back down, took some more pictures, came back out up, and nothing happened. So we called the campus security the next day, and I said, we're going to run a story about an alleged rape that happened on campus and the lack of security in dorm rooms. And they said, Reese, call us back in 5 minutes. So I waited about 10 minutes and called them back, and they said, we would advise that you don't run this story. And this newspaper got more coverage than the local paper in town.
Sure.
And so the next day, we wrote a very concise news story about what we saw. We ran the pictures of the open dorm room, mm-hmm. or doors to get into women's dorm. And we did a great job writing the story. I was working with another journalist who was a lot better writer than I was. I was just kind of off the cuff, always just trying to find the next adventure, very Hunter S. Thompson-ish in my actions. But that story changed me and, you know, really brought me here. Talking to you today because, so the next day, let me tell you this too. So we ran the story, and I told my journalism professor, I said, hey, look, they're threatening to kick me out of school. And I remember him saying, if they threaten to kick you out of school, and which won't happen. Or he said, if they threaten to kick you out of school because you wrote an investigative piece about a woman who was raped on campus and is no longer here, then you can sue the school for a lot of money. And I liked that word, investigative.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to give voice to this woman who left campus. She was probably scared to death. I never knew who she was. I hope that by telling that story, it gave her some kind of peace. The guy that was accused of doing this was an athlete new to school, and they were pressing charges, then not. We followed that for a few months. And, you know, at that time it was he said versus she said, right?
Right.
And what also happened, though, within 24 hours, there were padlocks on every one of those manholes on campus. So we knew we did the right thing.
I want to jump ahead to another part in the book and see if you'll read for us again, because as an adult who is leading writing classes in the prison, you're also working with women in prison, and you find these themes of sexual assault and trauma in the adult women in the prison as well. This is a section called Orange is Not the New Black. Would you read that for us?
Sure. Author Sarah Schottlin, who co-founded Words Without Walls at Chatham University, told me to give the women in my class this writing prompt first. Finish the statement. No one ever asked me. I read them the prompt and they began writing almost immediately. I reiterate to them that their stories carry more weight than they might think. I truly believe, and my gut tells me, that a lot of these women are in prison for addiction issues or simply hanging out with the wrong men. I continue to give them writing prompts. I present my lecture about the rape of a woman on my former college campus and how, as an undergraduate reporter, I reported on the crime and the lack of security on campus. I tell them how my investigative reporting helped me make the campus a more secure place. I speak with pride about how using my voice for the first time as a writer made all the difference for me. And that was also at a time, Lori, you know, you're a college student, you're flat broke, you've got nothing, right? And then you realize, no, wait a second. Nobody can take my voice from me. And we were fighting for a lot of really good things. So much so that piece about this investigative piece won a first place Nebraska Collegiate Media Association Award. And we weren't writing it to win an award. We didn't even know it was nominated until after the fact. But I remember that feeling of how powerful your voice is and how you can use it. And nobody can take that from you. And that made a big difference for me. One of the five women asks, "Do you really think giving somebody some advice is going to help them? That it's going to change anything?" "Yes," I said. She mocked me, said something I couldn't hear, and looked away. What I know about this particular student is what she shares about her family, that most of them are drug users. During our class, the educational supervisor on duty separates her from another woman. They are sitting too close and touching each other. I can tell the student isn't afraid to ask or say whatever it is that's on her mind, and I appreciate that. Another student talks about being raised by her grandmother and raped by her uncle and grandfather. After that, she was sent away to a foster family. At the end of her one-page piece, she apologizes to her grandmother. The essay is disturbing and sad. It wasn't her fault that her uncle and grandfather molested her. She doesn't owe anyone an apology. Here she is in prison, apologizing for being raped, unspeakable trauma that fueled an addiction as she tried to forget her past. Hearing and reading stories like this continues to make me question my faith in people. How on earth do these things continue to happen? Another student talks about getting right with the world, says fentanyl is her drug of choice, went from OxyContin to fentanyl to carfentanil, an elephant tranquilizer. She says she never did heroin. "What's the point?" I ask. "You can't get out of bed. You need a fix so bad, and then when you get it, you black out, it knocks you out?" "Yeah, scary," she continues. "You have good veins. I noticed them right when you got here. You and I could have a lot of fun together."
You're just tuning in. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. My guest this hour is Jim Reese. His new book is called Coming to a Neighborhood Near You. You mentioned Hunter S. Thompson and this idea of gonzo journalism and the way that you start writing in this screed-like form, you know, stream of consciousness, getting it on the page, getting it fast, going down the manhole, being, you know, the journalist who is not just sitting back and making phone calls, but going out into a space and doing something dangerous. Famously, Hunter S. Thompson had terrible problems with addiction, died by suicide at the end of his life. You are also going to struggle with the lifestyle that you have adopted. Now, you don't go on to become a journalist, but you go on to feel like part of being a writer is living a life that has inherent risks to it. Tell us a little bit about embracing that as you saw embodied in a journalist like Hunter S. Thompson.
Well, I always believed in immersing yourself in the story, and I bought into that Gonzo myth early in college. You know, on the whole left side of my calf is the Gonzo fist and peyote button and...
tattooed.
Yeah, and I lived by that. You know, I always thought where the adventure and entertainment is, that's where the story will be.
Buy the ticket, take the ride.
Indeed. When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. And so I bought into it, just like lots of male writers and female writers bought into, you know, their heroes like Hemingway and Kerouac and, to an extent, Anthony Bourdain and, you know, other people. And unfortunately, all of them died, a lot of them by suicide or alcoholism. But that's how I started, you know. I really believed that and bought into the myth. And then I was in Spearfish when I first moved up here, my first book tour, a poetry book. And Kent Myers and David Cremeen said, hey, if you really like Hunter S. Thompson, you need to know who the real Gonzo writer is. And it's Chuck Boden. Have you ever heard of him? And I had no idea who the guy was. And they said, you know, he's got a brand new issue in Harper's Magazine called Sicario, you know, an interview with a Juarez hitman. And he is able to find a place and interview this former cartel member who murdered over 200 people, who's got a bounty on his head, and who really wants to be saved by God now and also tell his story. And it's an incredible piece of writing. And when I read that, I realized this is what true Gonzo is, right? Boden was immersing himself on the border. You know, in 2007, Felipe Calderon declared a war on drugs. And, you know, his Secretary of State was in cahoots with the Sinaloa cartel. He was just prosecuted in 2023. So the government is working with the cartel. The cartel is working with the government. American government, Mexican government are working together. There's all kinds of corruption happening on the border. And then you've got these young men who can't make a living. There's no living wages being paid in Mexico. They see this as an opportunity. And there's no wonder they go to that life of crime. And, you know, as of now, I kind of keep track, and it's in the book. But since then, 2007, there's been over 500,000 murders as part of this drug cartel, and about another 100,000 missing people. So I really studied Boden, got to know him a year or two later at the South Dakota Festival of Book. We became friends, and I brought him to Mount Marty. That article, they actually made a documentary called Sicario, Room 164. We showed that at school, and everybody learned a lot, you know. A lot of Mexican journalists are being murdered. American journalists, not so much.
You write about this a lot in the book, so this is why I'm asking you about it. And if you don't want to talk about it, we can just direct people to get the book. When did it catch up with you? Your own drinking?
You know, yeah, since I was young. I mean, I was always anxious in high school and stuff like that, and alcohol just calmed my nerves. And then alcohol was fun. I suppose I'm no different from anybody else that likes to drink, right? It was fun, seemed to work pretty well for me, gave me strength. I thought it made me funny. And then my body just started depending on this liquid. And it's a liquid, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's probably, if I had to guess, I bet you there's 150 million people in the United States that liquids rule in their life, right? It's a part-time job. And I would always kind of try to tell myself, well, hey, you're really successful and, you know, you get off work, go have some drinks. And it just got worse and worse. My body just needed it. And I ran away from it. You know, people close to me had been trying to help me for a number of years. And yeah, I mean, I kept running and running, and to the point where one morning I couldn't hold a fork in my hand to cut a waffle. And I realized, you know, you can't hide this anymore.
Because your hands were shaking.
So bad.
Yeah. Inmates are noticing when you're going into the prison to teach that your hands are shaking. And you feel, you say in the book, like the biggest fraud in the world.
Yeah, I mean, my gig was up. I mean, I tried to open a pop can around 3:30 because my body was starting to want what it wanted. And I knew at 4 o'clock I would drive to a liquor store to get it, what it needed. And I had to open up a pop can and use two hands to do it. And the student in class, I was having conferences that day, and he just looked at me and he said, "It looks like you needed that drink." And I said, "I do."
I think it's really important, two things in the book, too, as you were mentioning Hunter S. Thompson and your pivot toward the work of Chuck Boden as someone to model yourself after, is you start realizing and deconstructing this idea of gonzo journalism to be, well, the reality here is someone's not doing their work.
Yeah.
And you want to model yourself after somebody who is doing their work. And then you start embracing your work more as a writer and your life as a runner, an athlete, someone who's exercising. And one of the most poignant lines that you have, I think more than once, is you're going on a run and you can't run in this part of the world without seeing discarded empty bottles on your run. And you're literally running past the person that you used to be, which is the person who would have emptied that bottle.
Yeah, I just noticed a little spot by my post office in Yankton, South Dakota, and I run by it, and there's just these little airport bottles, you know, of booze just piling up. So whoever's drinking, they just throw it out at the same spot. It gets bigger and bigger. But I don't think there's a gravel road or a road you can walk or run more than a mile and not see at least two empty containers of something. But, you know, and that's one of those deals where it's like, I'm learning so much about addiction inside. And I thought to myself, if you're going to write about your students and their problems, you better have the audacity to write about your own problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I mean, I remember the first time talking about this in my class. We were talking about some stuff, and I do remember this student's name. And I said, "Hey, you know, you might not think of me as the smartest guy in the room anymore. You might not respect me for telling you this story." And he said, he goes, "No, I respect you of a hell of a lot more than I ever did." He said, "Thanks for sharing your story." And that just tied into everything we were doing in class. Yeah.
Would you read for us again? There's a poem where you're working with an inmate who's trying to write, and you're kind of, you know, pushing him to say, hey, this thing that you put on the page is not the truth. You're hiding behind something. I think it's a really good example of what you had to face yourself as well, not just your students. Blanket of security.
Men in my class frequently write tributes to someone they love, often their child's mother or an ex-wife, usually someone they've hurt. When writing these reflections, they use predictable metaphors and cliches. They believe rhyme is important because they have read rhymes in greeting cards and heard them in song lyrics. When I ask one student who his poem is about, he says his ex, his baby mama. I ask him if he can recall an act of love, a specific moment he shared with this woman, something she might recall if he can invoke the right details, paint the right pictures, something special that will touch her. He looks at me and asks, "You don't like my poem?" "Not really. It's predictable." He pauses and looks down at his notebook. He takes his time responding. These are the critical seconds when a student either explodes or hears me. He says, "When I write about specifics, I get embarrassed." "Yeah, that's kind of the point. Your tough guy facade landed you here, didn't it?" I tell him about a time 20 years ago when I was on a road trip driving back home from Red Lodge, Montana. It was a long and windy trip. I asked my wife and a vanload of friends to describe one of their most memorable days with their significant other. My wife took her time thinking about it. It drove me nuts. "It was a day when we were raking leaves," she said, "and I remembered that day. It was the last house we rented. We didn't have that much money. I was in graduate school. We had raked these enormous piles of leaves, and we'd stuffed those brown recycle bags and lined them up on the curb like a chorus of fans, totems of the afternoon's accomplishments. And we had this loud basset hound named Do-Right, who would always bark and cause trouble. We had to buy one of those shock collars because the neighbors got so tired of the barking. The dog was ornery and just liked to play." I tell the student what I recalled from the day. "I remember the late afternoon, crisp but not cold. I had a glass of wine in a mason jar sitting on the ledge of the house trim. I was always drinking out of a box of wine back then. I remember we had one rake, those bags, my glass of booze, and piles of leaves. I don't remember any conversation or anything earth-shattering happening. We were just together, all our absolutes, failures, future, and hope. Ever since she told me that was a special day for her, I go back and think about it. Often our true love shows when we aren't trying. Does that sound cheesy to you?" He didn't take long to respond. "We used to love to go get the kid down to sleep, finally," he told me. "We'd pop in a VHS movie and just chill. It was our time. No one was trying to hustle. We could hold each other, be with each other, under this big quilted blanket, those heavy ones, you know? That's what you need to write to her," I tell him. "This man, who is not much different from me, right there, describe the colors of that blanket, its history, its weight, and security."
We're building a new prison in South Dakota, or at least we're talking about what it means to build a new prison in South Dakota. Much of your work has been in the criminal justice field, looking at what prisoners need for rehabilitation and examining people's attitudes about whether you should be teaching people behind bars anything at all. Help us understand some of the numbers behind incarceration in America that still stand out to you through your years of work.
Well, one of the first things that bothered me was a local, when I was living in Nebraska, he had said, "Why should we care about the work you're doing in prisons? Lock them up, throw away the key." And I needed facts to respond to their comments. And so here's one that just nails that comment. According to a 5-year bipartisan study by the RAND Corporation, every dollar spent on prison education equates to $4 to $5 taxpayer savings. So if you just care about your tax dollar, you should care about education behind bars. Why is mass incarceration a human rights crisis? According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, as of 2022, 1.8 million people in the U.S. are incarcerated, and there are another 3.7 million people under correctional supervision, probation, or parole. And as you know, the U.S. has roughly 5% of the world's population and houses 25% of the world's prisoners. Prisons are often overcrowded, violent, and inhumane. In 2021, Black Americans were imprisoned at a rate of 5 times that of white Americans, according to the Sentencing Project. And a few more here. Cash bail is the only option for the poor and disenfranchised, depriving people of rights and privileges, which leaves people locked up, communities broken, and families torn apart. There are 1,800 state and federal correctional facilities and 3,200 local and county jails in the United States, according to Christopher Ingram of the Washington Post. So to put these figures into context, we have slightly more jails and prisons, more than 5,000, than we do degree-granting colleges and universities. In many parts of the country, particularly in the South, more people live in prisons than on college campuses. And what's interesting to me just around here is I worked at 2 prisons within a 50-mile radius of my home in Yankton, and both of those prisons were colleges less than 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Each year we spend billions on criminal justice, but we increasingly spend less on education. U.S. prison recidivism rate is high. Within 3 years of release, 2/3 of those people released will return to prison. And one alarming thing, when I started teaching at the men's prison in Springfield, I heard this, and somebody said, it's a revolving door. And then 3 out of the 9 guys in my class raised their hands and said they believe they'd be coming back to prison after being released. And this just baffled me. And I blurted out, what? You don't even have any faith in yourself? You're already giving up? South Dakota has an incarceration rate of 824 per 100,000 people in prisons, jails, immigration, detention centers, and juvenile justice facilities, meaning that it locks up a higher percentage of its people than any democratic country on earth. And that's according to the 2021 Prison Policy Initiative report. In 2024, according to the South Dakota Department of Corrections, the state's 3-year recidivism rate was 44%. And in June, the LA Times reported South Dakota is on track to spend $2 billion on prisons in the next decade. Former penitentiary warden Darren Young said the state needs to upgrade its prisons, but he also thinks it should spend up to $300 million on addiction and mental illness treatments. And so there's some other solutions and things going on. You know, I think we could easily take some of that money. Let's say instead of spending, you know, $500,000 on a campaign about meth, we're on it. Well, we could have hired some teachers and put them in the prisons to help these students. There's a prison in Michigan that is just now started that is converting the whole place into an educational facility. So 1,000 of those inmates, as long as they have good behavior, they're going to be able to go to college. The title of the book, and I hope, you know, the first warden at the federal prison camp was very pro-education, and he gave a lot of certificates away, and he was always just happy to have graduation or ceremonies to celebrate the accomplishments of the men in prison. And he would always say, hey, these guys are coming to a neighborhood near you. Do you want them educated or not? Mm-hmm. And he would say that every time. And I remember after one time I said, you know, I love that you say that. And I said, I'm going to write a book about all of this. And I'm going to call it Coming. I'm going to call it Coming to a Neighborhood Near You. And he looked me square in the eyes. And he said, good, do it. His name was Jordan Hollingsworth. And I'm trying to find where he is. So I want to give him a copy of the book. So if you're out there listening, Jordan, look me up.
Yeah. At the end of this, for you as a writer, you've learned more from your students than perhaps they've learned from you. What's something that you take away? And then we'll do one more reading before we close.
What have I learned from my students? So much stuff. I mean, I remember my first supervisor of education said, Jim, you're going to do fine here. You just have to remember this one thing, and that is, you know, any of us could have wound up in a place like this after a few misdirected decisions, right? And I did want to go back and to mention this kind of mantra that I live by. After I went to San Quentin the first weekend, and we would be there and we would study their arts and theater and writing and woodworking and guitar and all these different arts programs going on. And then we would leave and talk to other advocates and facilitators, and we'd go back the next day, and they have their own newspaper in San Quentin. I think I read it in the newspaper or somebody told me, but it basically goes like this. You can lock people up and let them out after their time is served. And maybe during their incarceration, you can teach them a trade, and that's great. What you must do is help them tap into the emotional instabilities that brought them to prison in the first place. You know, if people never come to terms with themselves, you're just going to send angry people right back out into society. So that's when I read that and then lost my ego of telling everybody, hey, I'm going to San Quentin. You know, that sounded cool at first. And then I started reading these stories, and I knew I was helping these men and their families and breaking that cycle of crime. And hopefully then it wouldn't come back into the communities and just repeat itself. So that was something that I stick with and was important to me.
Jim Reese's new book, Coming to a Neighborhood Near You, The Repercussions of Crime and Punishment, comes out September 2nd. We've spent the hour exploring the themes of Reese's book with the author. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, we thank you for listening.